Commissioner Linda Bond, in charge of the Salvation Army in Eastern Australia. That's Queensland, New South Wales, the ACT. It used to be Papua New Guinea, but Papua New Guinea decided to become independent a few years ago and the Salvation Army duly established a separate territory there. Linda Bond is a Canadian by birth, been in Australia for just a few months, and we thought it time to get her into the studio and say hi. Linda Bond, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Linda Bond, the Salvation Army is one of those interesting Protestant churches that that has an international rather than a nationally based structure. So you as a Canadian have had the opportunity to skip around the world a fair bit.
Yes, I've been really blessed. After serving for many years in Canada, I had to go to the international office in London, England. So served there for 3 years, then went up to Manchester for just a year. Back to my own country, Canada, but then went to the United States and served in California, and the West Coast became the responsibility for me. Then now I'm here in Australia. So I've served in four countries, and my last appointment for 3 years, I basically traveled the army world.
You're a commissioner in the Salvation Army.
Yes.
Now, this is a sort of combination of an archbishop and a CEO, is it?
I suppose so. There's commissioners in the Salvation Army. Many of them would be responsible for the work of the army in a certain country or countries, territories, or commands. Generally territories, but others would be commissioners at IHQ, of course.
So. But it's a rank that has sort of the equivalent responsibility, I guess, if you're talking ecclesiologically, to an archbishop or that sort of rank, if you're talking in the church terms that people are familiar with.
Yeah, I always thought that. I thought it was the same as because the archbishops. I even wondered at times because of the cardinals electing the pope, because the commissioners elect the general. But yes, I would say yes, the archbishop more closely.
The Salvation Army also has a very heavy administrative workload through. The great social programs the Salvation Army operates. So this comes under your responsibility as well.
Yes. All the Salvation Army work that takes place in the Queensland, New South Wales, ACT, yes, ultimately comes under me.
You have also the stewardship of people's spiritual lives. Now, this can become a little complicated when you face a job like yours where the demands of office management and bureaucracy can be so all-consuming. And it's a question that confronts all spiritual leaders in this sort of situation. What prepares you to be able to handle that? Because as a bureaucrat, you've got to make tough decisions.
I guess what always comes to me when people think you have to juggle the roles of the administration or the disciplinarian and the compassionate counselor, spiritual director type of roles. See, to me, it's never ever a problem because Psalm 23 says the shepherd carries the rod and the staff. So I just think if I'm the shepherd of my people and the leader of my people, to show compassion without the discipline and the firmness and the goodness and the righteousness, that's sentimental much. And then to do the other, you know, just to be a CEO administrator that the bottom line is all that counts, to me is a legalism or a hardness that doesn't say much about Jesus Christ living in us. So I have to be honest now, John, I don't find it a big problem.
You're an ordained minister of the gospel. Many still have a problem with the idea of women being ministers. It's an issue which has come up from time to time here in Sydney, as a matter of fact. You're one of those who is in a leadership role as a minister of the gospel and in charge of the entire division of an organisation, the territory of Eastern Australia. How do other churches and other church leaders react to a woman in your position?
Well, I don't know. They're very kind to me, so I don't know what they say when I'm not around. Again, before I came here, one of the responsibilities I had was to represent the international headquarters, the general, at all the international ecumenical functions. So I did participate once a year in the Conference of Secretaries of Christian World Communions and sat around the table with mostly men And then even last week, I was in the heads of churches meeting here, and there were about 16 or 17 of us here for Australia, and I was the only woman. But, yeah, I know it's an issue for some people, but for me, my calling was so real to be a Salvation Army officer, and probably that's why the Lord brought me into this tradition, because I may not have been able to function or participate in other traditions. So to me, it's a matter of, this is what I was called to do. The Army has given me a voice, a place to stand. And I just do it to the glory of God. And if people have objections, and I'm sure even the Salvation Army, people have found through my officership, they would prefer to have a man. So what can I do? I just press on, because this is what I'm called to do, and this is what I was appointed to do.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest, Commissioner Linda Bond, recently appointed head of the Salvation Army in Eastern Australia. Linda Bond, what for you is the essence of the Christian life and the essence of personal spirituality?
The essence for me is my relationship with Jesus Christ. It's the most important thing in the whole world. And I tell people, and it's not just cliches. It's not just, oh, you know, she gets paid to say this. But there is nothing I would not give up. There's nothing I would not do for the Lord Jesus Christ. My whole life is marked by his love for me. It's transformed my life in a miraculous way. And I am a miracle of grace. I really am. And he has transformed me. He's comforted me. He's come to me in ways that I could only say have been serendipitous. But he's spoken into my life. He's convinced me of his presence. I've been set free. You know, I'm a slave who's been unshackled, and I'm one who has known the joy of salvation. So for me, this song basically says, you know, life is very busy. Life is very busy, but there's a still point of turning in our lives. There's a sacred space. There's a deep place where he comes, and you can operate out of that with security and confidence and rest. So for me, that song says it, you know, turmoils without within, make in my heart a quiet place and come and dwell therein. So I just can say to you, I experience that every day, the quiet place with the Lord, and I operate out of that.
Let's talk about the life you've lived, the places you've been, people you've seen. What is it that that made you decide that this was a vocation for you, that becoming an officer in the Salvation Army was something that would make sense for you?
Well, when I try to explain why I do what I do and who I am, I generally have to go back to my upbringing. And if you don't mind, because that to me is a thread, bigger than a thread, that explains who I am. My upbringing was on the east coast of Canada in Nova Scotia in a coal mining town. My mother was English, came to Canada at 17 years of age, married my dad, who was a coal miner's son as well. She was a very intelligent, natively intelligent woman, very strong, opinionated woman, but also was the mother of 13 children, and I'm the last. Two died as babies, but 11 of us grew up together. But because of the mines, the Cape Breton mines, they were run by the British, our family was strongly involved in the Union, in the Labour Party. So I grew up in a Labour environment where we talked politics all the time. I mean, the politicians, the fellows from the Union would sit around and they'd argue and fight and whatever, and they were all on the same side. But that's how I grew
up. It's the best sort of fight, really.
Well,
isn't it?
And the thing is, my mother probably, in all of that group, which were generally all men, was probably the most articulate of the voices. So I grew up with an us and them mentality, me always being the us. You know, we were the us. Them were the ones who were rich and got their money on the backs of the poor working people. But also in my home, my mother, because she was so intelligent, and her opinion counted. We never had a sense as a child, as children, that a woman was second rate. You see where I'm going with this? So this idea that I wouldn't have a place in the church would have been, I wouldn't have known it. Because in the home, my opinion as a child was as valuable, and as a woman, was as valuable as my big, tall, lanky brother's. It just happened because I had that kind of mother. And so we went to the Salvation Army, which was my father's home church, even though he didn't attend. But my oldest sister was, you know, almost anointed by the Lord with a love for the Salvation Army that was indescribable. So made us all go. And I didn't even enjoy it, actually. But I had to go. And we had to go to everything. And I'd laugh about this now, but her sort of approach to life was, you have to go, so we started. But if you start something, you're not allowed to quit. So I was stuck. I didn't want to be there, but I wasn't allowed to quit. However, in that little Salvation Army Corps, everything I know as a skill in officership to this day, I learned as a child. I didn't want to be an officer. I wanted to be a gym teacher. But I will say to you today, this is not something I decided to do. The calling to me was so real that there hasn't been a second in my life since that day I've ever doubted that I was born to do this. So basically, when you say, how did I decide? The only decision was to obey the Lord.
On Sunday night, our guest is Commissioner Linda Bond of the Salvation Army. Linda Bond, you've spoken a little of your upbringing there. That rich-poor divide, of course, that's something that the church has got into very much over the last 20 or 30 years, when you've seen, and it's been much spoken of in the last 2 or 3 weeks, when you see the, particularly in the United States, the evangelical churches have become very much identified with the Republican Party. And some people say, look, this has been a real problem for the church because it's got in danger of being identified with one side or politics. How do you handle that sort of dilemma?
Well, I think the real danger, and even when I say I'm from a Labour background, you know, as soon as I say that, that could marginalise people. No. And that's on a personal level. And I think the Salvation Army has been very wise that we just don't go out and say we're for this party or we're for that party. We're allowed our personal views. But as a Salvation Army, and I think that's where the churches have to be very, very careful. Because once you align yourself with a political party, you can be perceived by people, whether you want to or not, that you're always will then be in the back pocket of the politicians when you need to be sometimes the prophetic voice that takes on the politicians and says the unpopular thing.
Yes, being non-political doesn't mean being absent from issues.
No, not at all. No, because, again, I'm a political animal because I just love politics. I love watching elections. I love listening to the pundits. I love it. But the danger is once you affiliate too strongly with one side or the other, you marginalize yourself from your people who are on the other side, but you also may marginalize yourself from the issues to which you have to speak as a leader. Or, again, you're wanting the politicians to come alongside and help the army do its mission. Well, now, if you take the whole of the Salvation Army and take a great stand about the government, and then you go, say, and rap on the door and say, please, may we have your help, you then limit your service to people. And I think for the Salvation Army, we have been so focused on serving people without discrimination that I think that has to affect the way we take a political view. The service of the people, it's for him, Christ, it's for them, the people, and it's for life.
Let's get this straight. That means it doesn't affect the way, for example, you would handle an issue, say like gambling. Gambling is one of those issues which is bubbling along. It could become a major political issue at any moment. The Salvation Army will take a principled stand on gambling and say that to whatever party happens to be in government, state or federal.
No question. And I think that's where you have to separate it. I think you really do. You can't look at the gambling issue and say that's a certain political party's issue. it's an issue of society. So I think for the Salvation Army, we always have to be very clear. And any politician worth their salt, any government worth its salt, will allow the churches the freedom to express their kingdom values in a relevant way that will better society. And if they don't, I think they're the poorer for it.
That's become an issue in a number of democracies, Britain, Australia, the United States, I don't know whether it did in Canada, where political parties have said, if you're going to take our money, you're going to keep quiet about social issues that are in that area.
Well, when I was a divisional commander in one division in another country other than my own, and the liquor folk wanted to give us a great big donation, you see. And that was really difficult for me because I knew what this meant. So I said to the PR man, yes, I think we should take their yes, I said, they owe us this, you know. I said, we're the ones who are taking care of all the people who had the problems because of all of this. Yes, I said, they owe us the money. We're going to take it. But let them know now, this will not be a photo op. This is not going to be me shaking the hands and taking a check. No, they wouldn't give us the money. So,
you're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest, Linda Bond, Commissioner Linda Bond of the Salvation Army. Let's chat a little more about this issue of money. The big end of town always seeks to influence any charitable body. It wants to be seen to be doing the right thing. You yourself had a difficulty with the Kroc family, the McDonald's family, who wanted to give some money to the Salvation Army, and you had to sort that one out yourself. And that took some consideration on your part, didn't it?
Well, I have to be honest now. I had no difficulty with Joan Kroc. I found Joan Kroc to be a friend. In fact, I had the great, awesome privilege of being the one who received the donation. And I must tell you about this because this is really interesting. Joan Kroc lived in San Diego. And
this is the McDonald's
millions. The McDonald's, yes, billionaire. I was a territorial commander, and Joan Kroc wanted to meet me. So the chief secretary, the second in charge, and his wife, they knew Joan because they'd been stationed in San Diego. And then the divisional commander at that point and his wife, they took me to her summer home. And I met Joan Kroc. Well, when she knew my background, this, you know, the my mother and the labor background, and also she loved dogs, and her two little pups, one little pup in particular, really took to me, will say, I couldn't lose then with Joan Kroc. I was a winner. So anyway, but I think it was the whole idea that a woman, she was a bit of a feminist, you know, and a Democrat, by the way. But I think she was taken with the fact the Army actually had a woman and my background, a lot of those things. Well, we somehow connected. Now, having said that, I have to be very clear, I don't think I'm the one who won the gift from Joan Kroc. I think it was the fact that she built a Kroc Center in San Diego and we had a young officer couple there who did an amazing work. We actually proved ourselves trustworthy. I think Joan Kroc actually thought we were naively good. I don't think she could believe that officers would work so hard making her dream come true and get nothing in return. So I knew she was dying. When she was dying, they phoned me on holidays, and there was only a few of us knew she was dying, and she asked me to participate in the funeral. And I did in a memorial service with Jimmy Carter. So Jimmy Carter and I and the president emeritus of Notre Dame Cathedral spoke at a memorial service. Very private, very secure. But at that time, I knew the kind of money we were getting. So these other two speakers were talking about how generous she was to the South, to them, to their organizations. Well, see, I wasn't allowed to tell what I knew. And I was thinking, you ain't heard nothing yet. Because I knew they were going to announce this huge gift. So anyway, what had happened with this gift? Her lawyer had phoned me and said, you need to come in and talk to us. And I said, well, I happen to be in the northern part of the Western USA doing an officer's fellowship. And he said, I know you are, but I think you need to come in. We had to rearrange the schedule. I flew into San Diego. He took me to the headquarters, Joan's headquarters. She had now been passed away. And so we sat around a boardroom table, And her two trustees were there and the lawyer. So one trustee at either end and the lawyer across from me. And they ordered in lunch. This to me is always so funny. And it was on styrofoam, you know, it was in styrofoam. So I am sitting at this table eating a salad in styrofoam. And the lawyer sitting across the table, he said, I guess you want to know why we're here. We asked you to come down. I said, yes, I do. So he slid across the table, the part of the will that, you know, and he said, the bottom line is $1.5 billion, the residual estate of Joan Kroc, belongs to the Army. She wanted you to be the first to know and tell the Army. And it's to build Kroc centers across America. Well, you know, I didn't eat any more salad. I mean, just think of it now. Coal mining town when we hardly had food in our mouths. We were poor. And I'm sitting here. My mother wouldn't have believed it. She would have said, get out quick. There's something wrong with this money. But no, what happened then, of course, with the national leaders of the Salvation Army in America, we then had to get together and we had to decide, because legally you have to decide whether to take it. And we wanted to make sure we could turn it into a mission that the Salvation Army could be faithful to.
It's a bit like the famous quote about Rockefeller, where his advisor, when Rockefeller said he wanted to find a way of spending his money, he said, you're going to find it a lot more difficult to spend it than you were to earn it.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, Joan Kroc was beautiful. I have to be honest now, I still miss her, and I didn't have a lot of association with her, but she was absolutely a wonderful woman. Wonderful.
The other thing, of course, that made it difficult for the Salvation Army in that $1.5 billion allocated to essentially hardware meant you had to fill that hardware with things. I mean, plant and equipment is one thing, but how do you resource it? It's another, isn't it?
No. Joan was very bright, and she had learned from the Kroc Center that we'd built. In that, you know, she made sure that some of it was for the buildings themselves, but the other to run them. However, even with that, you're still looking at a huge overhead of expenses. So the Army very wisely said to communities, I mean, if you're going to get a multi-million dollar structure in your community, are you prepared to come to the table to help this operate up, you know, to put it on a good balance, a good footing financially for the years to come? And people were only too willing to do that.
You're on Sunday Night. John Cleary with you. Linda Bond is my guest, Commissioner of the Salvation Army in Eastern Australia. Linda Bond, let's talk a little bit about your first toe in the water in Australia. You've been here some 4 or 5 months now, enjoying the place. But there must be great similarities with the Salvation Army, say, in Australia and in Canada, perhaps a little different from the United States. What do you see?
Well, to me, it's almost been too easy, really. I keep waiting for the balloon to burst or the honeymoon to be over. The adjustment's been very easy because, first and foremost, I think the countries are very similar because of our colonial heritage. I mean, you know, you drive around here and you see Sydney, and, you know, and I drive around home and I see very, you know, the same names that Britain has, we all have. And even though we distance ourselves from the motherland sometimes, you can't drive around and look at places and say, oh, I recognize that from living in England.
There's one significant difference. I mean, Canada has snow, we have dust. You know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Canada does. Well, I can't imagine I'm going to spend Christmas in heat. That's beyond my comprehension, but we'll give it a go. So in terms of our countries, I think there's a similarity. And there's therefore, I think, a similarity in our army because, again, both of our armies have been very influenced by the British music. The impact of the British music, and yet we have our own identity. I think the feeling at home for me is not just Australia and Canada, as opposed to different from the United States. It's just that it's Salvation Army. Everywhere I go, if it's Salvation Army, I feel at home. And if it become so different to what I've been used to, I think, well, it's not the Army.
That is part of the organisation's genius too, isn't it? That it started off consciously in the late 19th century as consciously international, whereas most other churches coming out of the Reformation started off as consciously national.
Yes.
That leads to a quite profound difference in the way the organisation expresses itself.
I sometimes think you had said on one of your DVDs, it's country within a country that somebody had, you know, one of our historians have said, or one of our forefathers had said. I sometimes think of it as an embassy, you know, and I remember going into another country and saying, I know you think I'm an outsider, but really, in the truth, I belong here as much as you do, because it's like an embassy. We represent something bigger than ourselves within this country, and I'm part of that. I'm a Salvationist. So I when I come, I have that kind of a sense. I'm a Salvationist. We're all Salvationists.
What's the sense you have of the way the movement fits in contemporary society? Where do you see the Salvation Army's niche these days, given that it has a fairly distinctive appearance? Where do you think the Salvation Army fits in the complexity of what people are calling a sort of post-industrial age? And does it have a particular role still among the churches?
Yes, I think it not only has a particular role, I think we need to get to the point where we actually realize we've got even more to offer than we have in recent years. One of the things for me is that in Australia, more than any country or territory I've ever been in, we are loved by the public. We have an affection from the public that I've never seen equaled anywhere. We don't want to lose that. But we don't want to think we created either. I think this is truly the blessing of the Lord. And it's the blessing of the Lord because I think Salvationists in Australia have really served well and selflessly. And the people here have recognized that. So as long as there's need, truly, as long as there's need, and as long as the Salvation Army is prepared to meet that need in the name of Christ, in the name of Jesus Christ, I think we'll always have a place, no question. In the ecumenical landscape, the Salvation Army, to me, has a deep, deep theology. And sometimes we're only known as, you know, rolled up sleeves, but that is part of our theology. And what's behind the rolled up sleeves is a very deep, good theology. We're people who truly believe that holiness is not an airy-fairy kind of thing that, you know, makes you so heavenly-minded you're no earthly good. The Salvation Army has actually believed that to be pure in the sight of God and have Jesus live within you, you're so heavenly minded, you're most earthly good. So I think we need to recover our strong doctrine, our strong theology, because in the ecumenical landscape, I think it has an awful lot to say.
That theology, as you said, linking heaven and earth very, very positively, is something that people find increasingly difficult to do these days, particularly in urban environments where if you're isolated and live out in a middle-class suburb, you very rarely encounter physical need in the way that you can actually be physically involved in meeting that need. So that becomes a challenge for the army in talking to its own congregations, does it not?
Yes, and I know there's a good element in the Salvation Army who think that we should only serve the economic poor or the obviously marginalized. But when Jesus declared his mission, you know, the commentators would say the poor and the blind and the prisoner may not just be the literal physical needs, but you're talking about something deeper. Well, then if you take the Salvation Army's mission, we talk about saving souls. You know, there is a spiritual poverty and a spiritual blindness and a spiritual imprisonment. And if you want to even take it even deeper, where you have shallow Christians who only have enough religion to make them miserable, there is still a blindness and a bondage, really, and a poverty of spirit that the Salvation Army needs to speak into with a deep spirituality, and then you do have the actual physical needs. Well, our mission is so relevant, it blows me away. So they may be in the suburbs. They may have nice clothes, drive nice cars, but we may be looking at some of the poorest people we could ever possibly see. We need to speak into their lives as well.
And that's a mission that's constantly got to be refined. I mean, what the suburbs were 5 years ago may be totally different to what the suburbs are in a couple of years' time, given particularly the economic circumstances we find ourselves in at a moment like this. I mean, mortgage stress can do dreadful things to marriage as well as to finances.
Exactly. You know, human need is human need. So there's a sense in which, you know, I can look at you, John, and say You're doing really, really well. You don't need me. I need to go to the poor fellow sitting with the on the street. But if you have a broken heart and you need someone to speak to you about the deep things of God, I can't neglect you. And I think that's it. The Salvation Army can't neglect no one. And the neighbor, you know, in the Good Samaritan story, the neighbor is anyone whose need I'm in a position to meet. And I think that's how the Salvation Army has to see its mission.